Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. Today we'll be discussing story number 14 from Dubliners, which was called Grace. And then we will be reading the first half of story number 15. I'm not going to go the whole thing because yesterday when we did the whole story of Grace, it was something like 30 pages. And I think the reading suffers a little bit for that. And I also think the conversation suffers a little bit for that. We had very little conversation in the discussion forum about that chapter. In fact, it was the smallest amount of discussion yet so far this year, by quite a lot. There was only really two or three comments. And I think it's just because it's too much, right? The chapter is almost like a little novella, and there's too much to, like, by the time you finish it, you can't really remember all of it. So it's not fresh in your mind. And even by the time I finished reading that story last night, Grace, I think I even said something like, I've got no immediate comments, because I don't know why. When it's really long like that, it's just difficult to analyze it. There's almost too much there to analyze. And so you just kind of draw a blank. Anyway, long story short, I am going to read half of the last story in Dubliners today, which is called The Dead. I think it's the last one. Yeah, it is. It is the last one. It's a real longy. Yeah, I'm going to read the first half of it today, the second half of it tomorrow. And I reckon then we'll get some more conversation done around it, and things will just go smoother that way. The questions that I asked about short story 14, Grace, were these. How do you like Kernan's chances of recovery? What symbology do you think is woven into this story? One thing I noticed was the irony of a salesman biting his own tongue and inhibiting his own speech. I thought that was kind of poetic in a way, ironic, I suppose. And the other question I asked were, why did these men choose this sermon to bring him to? It was almost like a little intervention they were doing on him. And then they took him to a sermon, but the sermon was very stiff and non-spiritual and not very uplifting. It was very kind of businessy. It was almost like a self-help forum or something, like a small business forum. Another interesting fact that I found out by Wikipedia-ing this story was that Tom Kernan, the main character, was actually a real tea merchant in Dublin back in the day, and that Joyce's version is a fictionalized version of him. But Joyce's fictionalized version of him also appears in his novel Ulysses. So it's not the only time you see this character. And in fact, I don't know if this is... I don't think this is spoilery for me to say, but apparently in Ulysses, we see Tom Kernan further on in his life, and he is... so he's a bit older, and he is kind of like an alcoholic guy. So we can see, you know, a few times during this I've asked the question, like, where do you see this character in 5 years? And with this one, we kind of get an answer through Joyce's other work, which I think is kind of cool. Really didn't think Joyce would be the kind of guy to do like a cameo sort of thing. But hey, surprise. First up, Techrific has come in with the vocabulary needed for this story. Grace is the unmerited love and favour of God toward mankind. Ah, that's what grace is. That's so nice. The unmerited love and favour of God toward mankind. Unmerited. We don't deserve his love. Is that what that means? Unmerited? Unmerited means not deserved. Yeah. Huh. That's such a nice word, isn't it, grace? It's just got... I don't know. What is Hemingway, in fact, described grace as? Courage under pressure. Was that right? Courage under pressure? Grace is courage under pressure. He thought it was like the best virtue of a man. Anyway. Shah is Irish for yes. Ulster is a long, loose, heavy overcoat, especially one with a belt originally made of Irish frieze. Outsider is a horse-drawn carriage with two wheels. Ballast Office is the location of the Dublin Port and Docks Board. A gaiter is a cloth or leather covering from the instep and ankle and sometimes the calf of the leg, a spat or legging. A black white is apparently a renowned Irish salesman. EC means East Central. Debonair means of a man, confident, stylish and charming. The holy alls of it is slang for the long and short of it. Oh, that's cool. Fogarty's is a Dublin grocer. Her silver wedding is the 25th anniversary of a marriage. Pale means a territory or district within bounds. She believed steadily in the Sacred Heart means Mrs. Kernan displays an image of the Sacred Heart of Jesus in her home and takes communion on the first Friday of each month. Banshee is an Irish legend, a female spirit whose wailing warns of a death in the house. Bonafide travellers, inns and pubs were allowed to serve alcohol to travellers before or after hours, during which it was generally legal to do so. Thus, Mr. Harford and his friends travel to the suburbs so as to be allowed to drink legally on Sundays. Usurious is practicing usury, or the act or practice of lending money at a rate of interest that is excessive or unlawfully high. Usury was forbidden for centuries by the Roman Catholic Church. 7 days without the option of a fine means a week in jail. Palluthered is Irish slang for drunk or intoxicated. A true bill is a bill of indictment endorsed by a grand jury as supported by evidence sufficient to warrant a trial. A crusade in search of valises and portmanteaus to enable Mrs. McCoy to fulfill imaginary engagements in the country. Apparently, McCoy borrows luggage under false pretenses so as to pawn or sell it. Huh, interesting. Bostoons is Irish for rogues. Omad hounds means fools. Up here, to Dublin from the countryside. Wash the pot is slang for to confess one's sins. Secular priests, a Roman Catholic clergyman with parish duties, as opposed to those priests who live apart from society in a monastery or house. Father Tom Burke, an internationally popular Irish preacher of the 19th century. An Orangeman is, strictly speaking, a member of a secret Protestant society organized in Northern Ireland, 1795. Here the term is used to simply denote a Protestant and or Unionist. They don't believe in the Pope and in the Mother of God, a bastardization of the ways in which the beliefs of Protestants differ from those of Roman Catholics. A sod of turf under his oxter means that is, each student was expected to help heat the school by bringing fuel. In Ireland, turf was burned to provide heat. Oxter is slang for armpit. Huh. Up to the knocker means up to snuff or passable. Ex cathedra is Latin with the authority that comes from one's rank or office, often specially with respect to papal pronouncements or on matters of faith or morals that have authoritative finality. Oh God, that was a mouthful. Sorry about that. Often, let me read that again. Latin, with the authority that comes from one's rank or office, often specifically with respect to papal pronouncements or matters of faith or morals that have authoritative finality. Jeepers. Credo is Latin for I believe, right? Like credibility. Credo. Sir John Gray's statue, a statue of a Protestant patriotic located in the north central Dublin. Edmund Dwyer Gray is the son of Sir John Gray. A lay brother is, in this case, an usher in a church. Speck of red light is a sanctuary lamp within a Catholic church. Quinx-cunks is an arrangement of five objects in a square, with one at each corner and one in the middle, like the fifth side face of a six-sided die. Joyce used it to describe the seating arrangement of the five men in the church service. A critic named Lobner argues that in this context the pattern serves as a symbol both of the wounds of Christ and of the Greek cross. Surplice, a loose, white, wide-sleeved, outer ecclesiastical vestment for some services, ranging from hip length to knee length. And lastly, mammon, Riches regarded as an object of worship and greedy pursuit, wealth or material gain as an evil, more or less deified. From Matthew 6:24. Alright, there's a lot of vocabulary for this one. Thanks Techrific for posting that. Swim said the mama fishy said, in response to question one that I asked, which was, how do you like Kerman's chances of recovery? Swim said the mama fishy said, I don't like them much. As per his wife, she suspected that a man of his age would not greatly change before his death. As per question two, about what symbology did they find? Swim said the mama fishy said, I did not think of that, regarding the biting of the tongue being ironic for a salesman. It was interesting that the light in the church was a red light. Red lights are typically signs of a brothel, not a church. The priest's name is Purdon, and Purdon Street was infamous for prostitution. The priest's sermon pretty much boils down to a transactional spiritual accounting. Make sure you have enough grace and you are good to go. Kernan falls down the stairs. No grace there, and his life is going downward, so there's that. Grace. It's all about grace, and he's sort of disgraced himself, you could say. And then this sermon at the end, this priest is making it sort of transactional. It's like an accounting thing. And the topic of it is grace. Very interesting. And question three, what was question three? I have to scroll up here. Why did the men choose to take him to this particular sermon? They are all businessmen, so it made sense to me. Yeah, fair enough. It was a very business-like sermon. Swim said the mama fishy continued, the whole discussion on church doctrine and history was hilarious. Joyce's contempt of the Catholic Church comes through loud and clear in this story. It certainly does. Techrific said, I'm going meta for my comments because I understood very little about Joyce's intentions with this story. It seems to be about the Catholic Church and its followers and the tone of voice they use, respectively. The followers seem to know very little about their actual faith and the dogma it teaches, and the priest is condescending when trying to teach and preach to them, dumbing down the response about what the actual difference is between Catholics and Protestants. It all seems so meaningless and trite. I think Joyce is making some kind of statement, but he doesn't spell it out, so I can't really say for sure. So, on the meta points on the actual writing style and techniques, we seemed to have a real all-seeing point of view for the first time. We get inside Kernan's mind, his wife and his friends as well. We have three distinctly different scenes, as opposed to one or two in the other stories, so this appears to be a more elaborated story from the perspective of craft. It feels more like a novella than a short story. It's certainly different in character from the ones where we've had first-person narrator and third-person narrator, but the POV is only what the main character can know, see, and etc. So, in this one, we have an all-knowing narrator. From that perspective, this was quite entertaining, noticing the Joycean hand at work, so to speak. What do you guys think? I did notice that there were distinct sort of scenes in this story, maybe even a little bit more distinctive than some of the other ones. Almost like he could have put little chapter markers in there quite easily, especially 1, 2, 3. Like there was that first scene where he falls down in the pub, the second scene where his friends come to visit him at his house and give him that little intervention sort of thing, and then that third scene at the church. We could have easily split that story into those three parts. Probably should have on reflection, but hey, doesn't matter. I'm going to try to do that with today's story, though. I'll split it up in some opportune moment. The other thing I noticed was it was humorous. I thought it was really funny the way they were trying to be a bit coy with their trying to convince him to come to this sermon. Like they didn't want to upset him by saying, we think you need to come along to this thing. They were just like, oh, we're going to this thing. Hey, I didn't see you there. Almost like that kind of thing. I found that scene pretty entertaining. G.K. Hahn said, "His enthusiasm, or rather consent, to attend the religious retreat, I believe, was mostly influenced by the presence of his friends and the rather humiliating situation he was in. They all obviously look up to Mr. Cunningham, and his entreaties convinced him to give it a shot. It's not until later, when he actually goes to the church, he starts feeling the religious air, supported by the fact that he has seen familiar faces. It's almost like a social gathering of friends, with Mr. McCoy wanting to sit with his buddies. Rather than being on an inward individual nature, the gathering feels farcical, almost just for show. The priest seems to know that the religious laws don't work well in business." This chapter was filled with obvious religious references and implications, most of which I did not clearly get. However, I enjoyed seeing back and forth conversations and the fast-paced feeling. It did have a fast-paced feeling, I suppose, now that I think about it, because it was double the length of the other stories. But it didn't drag too badly. It didn't feel slow. Well, I do want to say a big thanks to G.K. Hahn, Techrific, Swim Said the Mama Fishy, for jumping in on this conversation. Your comments are always really thoughtful, and I can see you put a lot of effort into not just sort of saying, "I liked this chapter," or "I thought it was funny," or this or that, but you actually elaborate on what you're saying and make interesting points. So I really appreciate the effort you guys put into your discussion around these chapters. But saying that, that was all the discussion that we got around that chapter. It didn't really elicit much conversation, but that's okay. That happens time to time. So what we're going to do now is move on to the next story, which is called The Dead, story number 15, the last story in Dubliners. And I'm going to read about half of it for you today. Part one, we'll break it into two pieces and tackle it that way. I reckon that's the best way to proceed with this particular one. The thing about this project, and I noticed this with War and Peace, War and Peace worked so well because the chapters were all 3 to 5 pages on average, which is a good length. It's about 8 to 12 minutes of reading. And then you do about another 10 to 20 minutes of conversation, and you had your podcast episodes. They were all rounding out at somewhere between 15 minutes and half an hour. I reckon the average length of a podcast was like maybe 18 minutes or 20-something minutes, which is a good length for a daily podcast, I reckon. Yesterday's episode went for over an hour, and I think, which is fine, like some podcasts go for hours and hours and it's fine, but when it's a daily thing, we can't be going for an hour every time. So, I think what we'll try to do in the future is we're not rushing through these books. It's not like we're trying to get them all done within some time frame. So I think when we come across a particularly long chapter, we'll break it up in some way. Let me know in the discussion for this episode what you think of that idea. If you agree with it or not, I'm interested to see what you guys reckon. Anyway, let's move on. This is Story 15, The Dead, Part 1. Lily, the caretaker's daughter, was literally run off her feet. Hardly had she brought one gentleman into the little pantry behind the office on the ground floor and helped him off with his overcoat, than the wheezy hall door bell clanged again and she had to scamper along the bare hallway, to let in another guest. It was well for her she had not to attend to the ladies also. But Miss Kate and Miss Julia had thought of that and had converted the bathroom upstairs into the ladies' dressing room. Miss Kate and Miss Julia were there, gossiping and laughing and fussing, walking after each other to the head of the stairs, peering down over the banisters and calling down to Lily to ask her who would come. It was always a great affair. The Mrs. Morkins' annual dance, everybody who knew them came to it. Members of the family, old friends of the family, the members of Julia's choir, any of Kate's pupils that were grown up enough, and even some of Mary Jane's pupils too. Never once had it fallen flat. For years and years it had gone off in splendid style, as long as anyone could remember. Ever since Kate and Julia, after the deaths of their brother Pat, had left the houses in Stony Batter and taken Mary Jane, their only niece, to live with them in the dark, gaunt house on Usher's Island, the upper part of which they had rented from Mr. Fulham, the corn factor on the ground floor. That was a good 30 years ago, if it was a day. Mary Jane, who was then a little girl in short clothes, was now the main prop of the household, for she had the organ in Haddington Road. She had been through the academy and gave a pupils' concert every year in the upper room of the Antient Concert Rooms. Many of her pupils belonged to the better class families on the Kingston and Dalkey line. Old as they were, her aunts also did their share. Julia, though she was quite grey, was still the leading soprano and in Adam and Eve's, and Kate, being too feeble to go about much, gave music lessons to beginners on the old square piano in the back room. Lily, the caretaker's daughter, did housemaid's work for them. Though their life was modest, they believed in eating well. The best of everything, diamond-boned sirloins, 3-shilling tea, and the best bottled stout. But Lily seldom made a mistake in the orders, so that she got on well with her 3 mistresses. They were fussy, that was all, but the only thing they would not stand was back answers. Of course, they had good reason to be fussy on such a night. And then it was long after 10 o'clock, and yet there was no sign of Gabriel and his wife. Besides, they were dreadfully afraid that Freddy Malins might turn up screwed. They would not wish for worlds that any of Mary Jane's pupils should see him under the influence, and when he was like that it was sometimes very hard to manage him. Freddy Malins always came late, but they wondered what could be keeping Gabriel, and that was what brought them every 2 minutes to the banisters to ask Lily had Gabriel or Freddy come. "Oh, Mr. Conroy," said Lily to Gabriel when she opened the door for him, "Miss Kate and Miss Julia thought you were never coming. Good night, Mrs. Conroy." "I'll engage they did," said Gabriel, "but they forget that my wife here takes 3 mortal hours to dress herself." He stood on the mat, scraping the snow from his galoshes, while Lily led his wife to the foot of the stairs and called out, "Miss Kate, here's Mrs. Conroy." Kate and Julia came toddling down the dark stairs at once. Both of them kissed Gabriel's wife, said she must be perished alive, and asked was Gabriel with her. "Here I am, as right as the mail, Aunt Kate. Go on up, I'll follow," called out Gabriel from the dark. He continued scraping his feet vigorously while the 3 women went upstairs, laughing, to the ladies' dressing room. A light fringe of snow lay like a cape on the shoulders of his overcoat, and like toe caps on the toes of his galoshes, and as the buttons of his overcoat slipped with a squeaking noise through the snow-stiffened frieze, a cold, fragrant air from out of doors escaped from crevices and folds. "Is it snowing again, Mr. Conroy?" asked Lily. She had preceded him into the pantry to help him off with his overcoat. Gabriel smiled at the 3 syllables she had given his surname and glanced at her. She was a slim, growing girl, pale in complexion, and with hay-coloured hair. The gas in the pantry made her look still paler. Gabriel had known her when she was a child and used to sit on the lowest step nursing a rag doll. "Yes, Lily," he answered, "and I think we're in for a night of it." He looked up at the pantry ceiling, which was shaking with the stamping and shuffling of feet on the floor above, listening for a moment to the piano, and then glanced at the girl, who was folding his overcoat carefully at the end of a shelf. "Tell me, Lily," he said in a friendly tone, "do you still go to school?" "Oh, no, sir," she answered. "I'm done schooling this year and more." "Oh, then," said Gabriel gaily, "I suppose we'll be going to your wedding one of these fine days with your young man, eh?" The girl glanced back at him over her shoulder, and said with great bitterness, "The men that is now is only all a palaver and what they can get out of you." Gabriel coloured, as if he felt he had made a mistake, and without looking at her kicked off his galoshes and flicked actively with his muffler at his patent leather shoes. He was a stout, tallish young man, the high colour of his cheeks pushed upwards even to his forehead, where it scattered itself in a few formless patches of pale red, and on his hairless face there scintillated restlessly the polished lenses and the bright gilt rims of the glasses which screened his delicate and restless eyes. His glossy black hair was parted in the middle and brushed in a long curve behind his ears, where it curled slightly beneath the groove left by his hat. When he had flickered luster into his shoes, he stood up and pulled his waistcoat down more tightly on his plump body. Then he took a coin rapidly from his pocket. "Oh, Lily," he said, thrusting it into her hands, "it's Christmas time, isn't it? Just, here's a little..." He walked rapidly towards the door. "Oh, no, sir," cried the girl, following him. "Really, sir, I wouldn't take it." "Christmas time, Christmas time," said Gabriel, almost trotting to the stairs and waving his hand to her in deprecation. The girl, seeing that he had gained the stairs, called out after him, "Well, thank you, sir." He waited outside the drawing-room door until the waltz should finish, listening to the skirts that swept against it and to the shuffling of feet. He was still discomposed by the girl's bitter and sudden retort. It had cast a gloom over him which he tried to dispel by arranging his cuffs and the bows of his tie. He then took from his waistcoat pocket a little paper and glanced at the headings he had made for his speech. He was undecided about the lines from Robert Browning, for he feared they would be above the heads of his hearers. Some quotation that they would recognize from Shakespeare or from the Melodies would be better. The indelicate clacking of the man's heels and the shuffling of their soles reminded him that their grade of culture differed from his. He would only make himself ridiculous by quoting poetry to them which they could not understand. They would think that he was airing his superior education. He would fail with them just as he had failed with the girl in the pantry. He had taken up a wrong tone. His whole speech was a mistake from first to last, an utter failure. Just then his aunts and his wife came out of the ladies' dressing room. His aunts were two small, plainly dressed old women. Aunt Julia was an inch or so the taller. Her hair, drawn low over the tops of her ears, was grey, and grey also, with darker shadows, was her large, flaccid face. Though she was stout in build and stood erect, her slow eyes and parted lips gave her the appearance of a woman who did not know where she was or where she was going. Aunt Kate was more vivacious. Her face, healthier than her sister's, was all puckers and creases, like a shriveled red apple, and her hair, braided in the same old-fashioned way, had not lost its ripe nut colour. They both kissed Gabriel frankly. He was their favourite nephew, the son of their dead elder sister, Ellen, and who married T.J. Conroy of the Port and Docks. "Greta tells me you're not going to take a cab back to Monkstown tonight, Gabriel," said Aunt Kate. "No," said Gabriel, turning to his wife. "We had quite enough of that last year, hadn't we? Don't you remember, Aunt Kate, what a cold Greta got out of it? Cab windows rattling all the way, and the east wind blowing in after we passed Merion. Very jolly it was. Greta caught a dreadful cold." Aunt Kate frowned severely and nodded her head at every word. "Quite right, Gabriel, quite right," she said. "You can't be too careful." "But as for Greta there," said Gabriel, "she'd walk home in the snow if she were let." Mrs. Conroy laughed. "Don't mind him, Aunt Kate," she said. "He's really an awful brother, what with green shades for Tom's eyes at night and making him do the dumbbells and forcing Eva to eat the stirabout. The poor child. And she simply hates the sight of it, oh, but you'll never guess what he makes me wear now." She broke out into a peal of laughter and glanced at her husband, whose admiring and happy eyes had been wandering from her dress to her face and her hair. The two aunts laughed heartily too, for Gabrielle's solicitude was a standing joke with them. "Galoshes," said Mrs. Conroy. "That's the latest. Whenever it's wet underfoot, I must put on my galoshes. Tonight, even, he wanted me to put them on, but I wouldn't. The next thing he'll buy me will be a diving suit. Gabriel laughed nervously and patted his tie reassuringly, while Aunt Kate nearly doubled herself, so heartily did she enjoy the joke. The smile soon faded from Aunt Julia's face, and her mirthless eyes were directed towards her nephew's face. After a pause, she asked, "And what are galoshes, Gabriel?" "Galoshes, Julia," exclaimed her sister. "Galoshes, goodness me, don't you know what galoshes are? You wear them over your boots, Greta, isn't it?"
"Yes," said Mrs. Conroy.
"Gutta percha things. We both have a pair now. Gabriel says everyone wears them on the continent."
"Oh, on the continent," murmured Aunt Julia, nodding her head slowly.
Gabriel knitted his brows and said, as if he were slightly angered, "It's nothing very wonderful, but Greta thinks it very funny because she says the word reminds her of Christie Minstrels."
"But tell me, Gabriel," said Aunt Kate, with brisk tact, "of course, you've seen about the room. Greta was saying..."
"Oh, the room is all right," replied Gabriel. "I've taken one in the Gresham."
"To be sure," said Aunt Kate, "by far the best thing to do. And the children, Greta, you're not anxious for them?"
"Oh, for one night," said Mrs. Conroy. "Besides, Bessie will look after them."
"To be sure," said Aunt Kate again. "What a comfort it is to have a girl like that. One you can depend on. There's that Lily, I'm sure. I don't know what has come over her lately. She's not the girl she was at all."
Gabriel was about to ask his aunt some questions on this point, but she broke off suddenly to gaze after her sister, who had wandered down the stairs and was craning her neck over the banisters.
"Now I ask you," she said almost testily, "where is Julia going? Julia, Julia, where are you going?"
Julia, who had gone halfway down one flight, came back and announced blandly, "Here's Freddy." At the same moment, a clapping of hands and a final flourish of the pianist told that the waltz had ended. The drawing-room door was opened from within and some couples came out. Aunt Kate drew Gabriel aside hurriedly and whispered into his ear, "Slip down, Gabriel, like a good fellow, and see if he's all right, and don't let him up if he's screwed. I'm sure he's screwed. I'm sure he is."
Gabriel went to the stairs and listened over the banisters. He could hear two persons talking in the pantry. Then he recognized Freddy Mallon's laugh. He went down the stairs noisily.
"It's such a relief," said Aunt Kate to Mrs. Conroy, "that Gabriel is here. I always feel easier in my mind when he's here. Julia, there's Miss Daly and Miss Power will take some refreshment. Thanks for your beautiful waltz, Miss Daly. It made lovely time."
A tall, wizen-faced man with a stiff, grizzled moustache and swarthy skin who was passing out with his partner said, "And may we have some refreshment too, Miss Morkan?"
"Julia," said Aunt Kate summarily, "and here's Mr. Brown and Miss Furlong. Take them in, Julia, with Miss Daly and Miss Power."
"I'm the man for the ladies," said Mr. Brown, pursing his lips until his moustache bristled and smiling in all his wrinkles. "You know, Miss Morkan, the reason they are so fond of me is..." He did not finish his sentence, but seeing that Aunt Kate was out of earshot, at once led the three young ladies into the back room. The middle of the room was occupied by two square tables placed end to end, and on these Aunt Julia and the caretaker were straightening and smoothing a large cloth. On the sideboard were arrayed dishes and plates, and glasses and bundles of knives and forks and spoons. The top of the closed square piano served also as a sideboard for viands and sweets. At a smaller sideboard, in one corner, two young men were standing, drinking hop bitters. Mr. Brown led his charges thither and invited them all in jest to some ladies' punch, hot, strong, and sweet. As they said they never took anything strong, he opened three bottles of lemonade for them. Then he asked one of the young men to move aside, and, taking hold of the decanter, filled out for himself a goodly measure of whiskey. The young men eyed him respectfully while he took a trial sip. "God help me," he said, smiling. "It's the doctor's orders." His wizened face broke into a broader smile, and the three young ladies laughed in musical echo to his pleasantry, swaying their bodies to and fro with nervous jerks of their shoulders. The boldest said, "Oh, no, Mr. Brown, I'm sure the doctor never ordered anything of the kind." Mr. Brown took another sip of his whiskey and said, with sidling mimicry, "Well, you see, I'm like the famous Mrs. Cassidy, who is reported to have said, 'Now, Mary Grimes, if I don't take it, make me take it, for I feel I want it. His hot face had leaned forward a little too confidentially, and he had assumed a very low Dublin accent, so that the young ladies with one instinct received his speech in silence. Miss Furlong, who was one of Mary Jane's pupils, asked Miss Daly what was the name of the pretty waltz she had played, and Mr. Brown, seeing that he was ignored, turned promptly to the two young men who were more appreciative. A red-faced young woman dressed in pansy came into the room, excitedly clapping her hands and crying, "Quadrillas, quadrillas!" Close on her heels came Aunt Kate, crying, "Two gentlemen and three ladies, Mary Jane." "Oh, here's Mr. Bergen and Mr. Kerrigan," said Mary Jane. "Mr. Kerrigan, will you take Miss Power? Miss Furlong, may I get you a partner, Mr. Bergen? Oh, that'll just do now." "Three ladies, Mary Jane," said Aunt Kate. The two young gentlemen asked the ladies if they might have the pleasure, and Mary Jane turned to Miss Daly. "Oh, Miss Daly, you're really awfully good. After playing for the last two dances, but really we're so short of ladies tonight."
"I don't mind in the least, Miss Morkan. But I've a nicer partner for you, Mr. Bartell Darcy, the tenor. I'll get him to sing later on. All Dublin is raving about him."
Lovely voice," said Aunt Kate. As the piano had twice begun the prelude to the first figure, Mary Jane led her recruits quickly from the room. They had hardly gone when Aunt Julia wandered slowly into the room, looking behind her at something.
"What is the matter, Julia?" asked Aunt Kate anxiously. "Who is it?"
Julia, who was carrying in a column of table napkins, turned to her sister and said simply, as if the question had surprised her, "It's only Freddy, Kate, and Gabriel with him." In fact, right behind her, Gabriel could be seen piloting Freddy Mallins across the landing. The latter, a young man of about 40, was of Gabriel's size and build, with very round shoulders. His face was fleshy and pallid, touched with colour only at the thick hanging lobes of his ears and the wide wings of his nose. He had coarse features, a blunt nose, a convex and receding brow, tumid and protruded lips. His heavy-lidded eyes and the disorder of his scanty hair made him look sleepy. He was laughing heartily in a high key at a story which he had been telling Gabriel on the stairs, and at the same time rubbing the knuckles of his left fist backwards and forwards into his left eye.
"Good evening, Freddy," said Aunt Julia. Freddy Mallins bade the Mrs. Morkan good evening, in what seemed an offhand fashion by reason of the habitual catch in his voice, and then, seeing that Mr. Brown was grinning at him from the sideboard, crossed the room on the rather shaky legs, and began to repeat, in an undertone, the story he had just told to Gabriel.
"He's not so bad, is he?" said Aunt Kate to Gabriel. Gabriel's brows were dark, but he raised them quickly and answered, "Oh, no, hardly noticeable."
"Now, isn't he a terrible fellow?" she said, "and his poor mother made him take the pledge on New Year's Eve. But come on, Gabriel, into the drawing-room."
Before leaving the room with Gabriel, she signalled to Mr. Brown by frowning and shaking her forefinger in warning to and fro. Mr. Brown nodded in answer, and, when she had gone, said to Freddy Mallins, "Now then, Teddy, I'm going to fill you out a good glass of lemonade just to buck you up." Freddy Mallins, who was nearing the climax of his story, waved the offer aside impatiently, but Mr. Brown, having first called Freddy Mallins' attention to the disarray in his dress, filled out and handed him a full glass of lemonade. Freddy Mallins' left hand accepted the glass mechanically, his right hand being engaged in the mechanical readjustment of his dress. Mr. Brown, whose face was once more wrinkling with mirth, poured out for himself a glass of whiskey while Freddy Mallins exploded, before he had well reached the climax of his story, in a kink of high-pitched bronchitic laughter, and, setting down his untasted and overflowing glass, began to rub the knuckles of his left fist backwards and forwards into his left eyes, repeating words of his last phrase as well as his fit of laughter, would allow him. Gabriel could not listen while Mary Jane was playing her academy piece, full of runs and difficult passages, to the hushed drawing room. He liked music, but the piece she was playing had no melody for him, and he doubted whether it had any melody for the other listeners, though they had begged Mary Jane to play something. Four young men who had come from the refreshment room to stand in the doorway at the sound of the piano had gone away, quietly, in couples after a few minutes. The only persons who seemed to follow the music were Mary Jane herself, her hands racing along the keyboard, or lifted from it at the pause like those of a priestess in momentary imprecation, and Aunt Kate standing at her elbow to turn the page. Gabriel's eyes, irritated by the floor which glittered with beeswax under the heavy chandelier, wandered to the wall above the piano. A picture of the balcony scene in Romeo and Juliet hung there, and beside it was a picture of the two murdered princes in the tower which Aunt Julia had worked in red, blue, and brown wools when she was a girl. Probably in the school they had gone to as girls, that kind of work had been taught for 1 year. His mother had worked for him as a birthday present a waistcoat of purple tabinet, with little foxes' heads upon it, lined with brown satin and having round mulberry buttons. It was strange that his mother had had no musical talent, though Aunt Kate used to call her the brains carrier of the Morkan family. Both she and Julia had always seemed a little proud of their serious and matronly sister. Her photograph stood before the pier glass. She held an open book on her knees and was pointing out something in it to Constantine, who, dressed in a man-o'-war suit, lay at her feet. It was she who had chosen the name of her sons, for she was very sensible of the dignity of family life. Thanks to her, Constantine was now senior curate in Balbogan, and thanks to her, Gabriel himself had taken his degree in the Royal University. A shadow passed over his face as he remembered her sullen opposition to his marriage. Some slighting phrases she had used to still rankled in his memory. She had once spoken of Greta as being country cute, and that was not true of Greta at all. It was Greta who had nursed her during all her last long illness in their house in Monkston. He knew that Mary Jane must be near the end of her piece, for she was playing again the opening melody with runs of scales after every bar, and while he waited for her to end, the resentment died down in his heart. The piece ended with a trill of octaves in the treble and a final deep octave in the bass. Great applause greeted Mary Jane as, blushing and rolling up her music nervously, she escaped from the room. The most vigorous clapping came from the four young men in the doorway who had gone away to the refreshment room at the beginning of the piece, but had come back when the piano had stopped. Lances were arranged. Gabriel found himself partnered with Miss Ivors. She was a frank-mannered, talkative young lady, with a freckled face and prominent brown eyes. She did not wear a low-cut bodice, and the large brooch which was fixed in the front of her collar bore on it an Irish device and motto. When they had taken their places, she said abruptly, "I have a crow to pluck with you." "With me," said Gabriel. She nodded her head gravely. "What is it?" asked Gabriel, smiling at her solemn manner. "Who is G.C.?" answered Miss Ivors, turning her eyes upon him. Gabriel coloured and was about to knit his brows as if he did not understand, when she said bluntly, "Oh, innocent Amy, I have found out that you write for the Daily Express. Now aren't you ashamed of yourself?" "Why should I be ashamed of myself?" asked Gabriel, blinking his eyes and trying to smile. Well, I'm ashamed of you, said Miss Ivers, frankly. To say you'd write for a paper like that, I didn't think you were a West Briton. A look of perplexity appeared on Gabriel's face. It was true that he wrote a literary column every Wednesday in the Daily Express, for which he was paid 15 shillings. But that did not make him a West Briton, surely. The books he received for review were almost more welcome than the paltry cheque. He loved the feel of the covers and to turn the pages over of newly printed books. Nearly every day when his teaching in the college was ended, he used to wander down the quays to the second-hand booksellers, to Hickey's on Bachelor's Walk, to Webb's or Massey's on Ashton Quay, or to the O'Clohissies in the By Street. He did not know how to meet her charge. He wanted to say that literature was above politics, but they were friends of many years' standing, and their careers had been parallel, first at the university, and then as teachers. He could not risk a grandiose phrase with her. He continued blinking his eyes and trying to smile, and murmured lamely that he saw nothing political in writing reviews of books. When their turn to cross had come, he was still perplexed and inattentive. Miss Ivers promptly took his hand in a warm grasp and said in a soft, friendly tone, "Of course I was only joking. Come, we cross now." When they were together again, she spoke of the university question, and Gabriel felt more at ease. A friend of hers had shown her his review of Browning's poems. That was how she had found out the secret, but she liked the review immensely. Then she said suddenly, "Oh, Mr. Conroy, will you come for an excursion to the Aran Isles this summer? We're going to stay there a whole month. It will be splendid out in the Atlantic. You ought to come. Mr. Clancy is coming, and Mr. Kilkelly and Kathleen Kearney. It would be splendid for Greta to come, too. She's from Connacht, isn't she?" "Her people are," said Gabriel shortly. "But you will come, won't you?" said Mrs. Ivers, laying her hand eagerly on his arm. "The fact is," said Gabriel, "I have just arranged to go..." "Go where?" asked Mrs. Ivers. "Well, you know, every year I go for a cycling tour with some fellows and so..." "But where?" asked Mrs. Ivers. "Well, we usually go to France or Belgium or perhaps Germany," said Gabriel awkwardly. "And why do you go to France and Belgium," said Miss Ivers, "instead of visiting your own land?" "Well," said Gabriel, "it's partly to keep in touch with the languages and partly for a change." "And haven't you your own language to keep in touch with, Irish?" asked Miss Ivers. "Well," said Gabriel, "if it comes to that, you know, Irish is not my language." The neighbours had turned to listen to the cross-examination. Gabriel glanced right and left nervously and tried to keep his good humour under the ordeal which was making a blush invade his forehead. "And haven't you your own land to visit?" continued Mr. Ivers, "that you know nothing of, your own people, your own country." "Oh, to tell you the truth," retorted Gabriel suddenly, "I'm sick of my own country, sick of it." "Why?" asked Miss Ivers. Gabriel did not answer, for his retort had heated him. "Why?" repeated Miss Ivers. They had to go visiting together, and as she had not answered her, Miss Ivers said warmly, "Of course, you've got no answer." Gabriel tried to cover his agitation by taking part in the dance with great energy. He avoided her eyes for he had seen a sour expression on her face. But when they met in the long chain, he was surprised to feel his hand firmly pressed. She looked at him from under her brows for a moment quizzically until he smiled. Then, just as the chain was about to start again, she stood on tiptoe and whispered into his ear, "West Briton." All right, I think I'll end the reading for today on that note. It goes through a little bit of a change of, paragraph there, so it seems like a good moment. There's a little beat there that we can choose as a good place to pause. I've just noticed while I was reading, this story is really long. So yesterday's story was about 30 pages, which is something like double the length of the other stories in Dubliners. It was a really long one, 30 pages. I've just noticed that today's story, the last one, is 60 pages long. Which will mean, I think what we're going to have to do is break it into thirds. I think I'll do about 20 pages-ish, and we'll do it in thirds. So it won't be part 1 and 2, it'll be part 1, 2, and 3. And that's actually good, because we had scheduled to start Wuthering Heights on the 4th of Feb, and so that will round us out till then. That should work perfectly, I think, if my math is right. Anyway, that's what I'm going to do. I'll do it in thirds. Have your say about today's reading at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. I'll leave a few discussion prompts there, and I look forward to reading what you all have to say. Thank you very much for listening today, and I'll see you tomorrow.